Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Do you like ham and eggs? If you do, this episode of Tech Bites is for you. Good morning, Heritage Radio Network listeners. If you have been on with us since earlier this morning at 10 o'clock, we have an extra special treat for you. Staying in the studio, we have Erin Fairbanks, who is your host from The Farm Report, which was up at 10 o'clock. She's doing kind of like a doubleheader today, which is exciting. We're very happy to have her in the guest seat in the studio. She kind of got up, walked around the table, and sat down. Welcome.
Thank
but you.
You
were here when I got here, so thanks for staying.
Anytime.
She is also Heritage Radio Network's executive director, and she also works with Heritage Foods USA, which is the founding inspirational parent sort of company starter of Heritage Radio Network, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. We have a great show about ham and eggs today. First up, we're going to be talking about the eggs, and on the line from Denver, we have Austin Johnson.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So as usual, we start off every episode of Tech Bites going around the room talking about apps that we like, old favorites, new ones we've discovered. And since Erin really doesn't get to talk about tech much on her show, we'll let her talk tech first. I know you're very app savvy, although following your social media, you've been having some troubles with your iPhone.
I've been under the black cloud of like iPhone destruction. So definitely doing my annual donation to Apple is higher than normal in 2016. But what are you going to do? I am going to revisit, actually, it's not a new app, but it's an app with a new feature that I have been playing around with. And it is Instagram. Earlier this summer, they introduced a new kind of story feature that is, you know, primed to compete with Snapchat. It's more kind of ephemeral. You post short videos or photos with text overlays or, you know, emoji overlays that disappear within 24 hours. And so it was really going back and forth for the radio network, whether it made sense for us to launch our own kind of Snapchat account. But being a small nonprofit, felt like, man, I don't think we can really manage a whole other social media feed. And then Instagram Stories emerged and allows us to kind of explore kind of storytelling in that same way via a platform that we already have like a really nice audience on. So I will say it is not as much fun as Snapchat. It does not have all the cool kind of filters and features and kind of share things that I love about Snapchat. But it has been really interesting for us to give a little bit more of like a behind the scenes take. And if folks are tuned in, I'm going to do a little bit of a behind the scenes scan of the studio right now from the Heritage account so you guys can take a peek at the woman behind the mic.
And Heritage on Instagram is?
Heritage_radio.
Very nice. Well, I'm glad I have a clean t-shirt on today.
Yeah, thank you for that.
You never know in this day and age. I mean, we're under the cover of radio, but we are actually talking about live stream and periscoping and doing some video while we're on the show. So stay tuned for that maybe later this fall season. Hey.
Hello, Instagram.
Hi. Another. Another thing about Instagram that I was just thinking about this morning when I was looking around, Tech Bytes, at Tech Bytes HRN is our Instagram feed. I'm thinking about shifting it from a personal account to a business account because it is the account for the show. And that also is a new feature with the recent Instagram update.
I would recommend it. We did that. We made that switch about 2 months ago. And I think the primary benefit is you get some really great analytics. What I don't know...
You also get the contact button.
Yeah, and the contact button is nice. But I don't know how it impacts, you know, the frequency with which you show up in feeds. Because via Facebook, I know it really feels like businesses are in this very kind of like boxed in, pay-to-play space. And Instagram has already made the change of like not just posting things chronologically, but working off an algorithm. And I do have a small concern that identifying as a business puts you into a different algorithm category that may not be where you want to be.
Interesting.
But I don't know. I don't know.
Well, stay tuned. That'll be a work in progress also. David, do you have an app for us this week? And that's David Tattasori, who is our engineer and the Heritage Radio station manager, who turns this lovely shipping container chat into broadcast radio.
I turn the crank.
Yep.
I make the electricity happen.
Mission control.
Yep. I'm kind of running out of apps. I use like three apps in my daily life, and I think two of them are made by Google, but I'll give you the other one. I use this app called Double Twist on a daily basis. It's just a music player. Nothing fancy, no bells and whistles, just how I keep my music organized. Again, I'm an Android user, so I don't have the ubiquitous iTunes on my phone, so this is what I use.
Okay, you always come through with music apps.
I'm a music guy.
Okay. Well, see, the apps segment is exciting because not only do we get to potentially discover new apps for our own personal use, but it's also a nice insight into people's, you know, private lives and their personalities and a little bit of what makes them tick.
Slice of life.
Exactly. Austin, do you have an app that you really use a lot or a new one you've just discovered or maybe an old favorite that's been sitting on your phone ever since you got it?
Absolutely. I'd love to share one. Way off topic, but as long as that's okay. I'm a pretty big-time fantasy football nerd. I love playing fantasy football, love the numbers, love the analytics of it, and there's an app out there called Sleeperbot, which is actually an algorithm that some people made that looks for news, emerging news on Twitter and various news outlets. And the goal of the app is to get fantasy football related news to its users absolutely first. Even if it's just by a few seconds, that can be the difference between an advantage and a disadvantage in a fantasy football league. So it's one I've been using probably way too much lately.
So spell that for us.
Sleeperbots, S as in Sam, LEEPERBOT, Sleeperbot.
And is it a free app?
It is a free app.
For both Android and iPhone?
I am not positive it's for Android. I use it on iPhone, but I'd assume it's for Android as well.
Well, if it wasn't, that would give iPhone users a really competitive edge.
Advantage, yeah.
Advantage in the fantasy football arena. So my app this week is called Pocket, and it's new-ish. I mean, it wasn't from the first round of app releases. It's been around for a little bit. It allows you to save articles and things to read online in an offline native folder on your phone. And given everything that's happening in the world today and all the, you know, rapid news cycles and different things, there's a lot of articles that I come across in social media, online, in my news app that I want to read. But I'm trying to moderate my cell phone use. So I find that by saving all the articles I want to read in Pocket and then reading them all later on the subway or sitting down, you know, in the evening and saying, now I'm going to do all my reading. Somehow I spend a little bit less time on my phone because then I don't get in the rabbit hole of oh, and then I'm going to click on this, and I'm going to click on this related story. So it helps me kind of focus, and also gives me an opportunity to read a little bit later in the day. So Pocket, it's free. It's pretty good. It'll also start to recommend articles for you if you want. But it's pretty handy right now, especially when we're in a time of year where there's lots of stuff happening. So Austin is on the phone with us today. He is the egg portion of our Ham and Egg show. I am an advisor and a mentor for a food tech accelerator in New York City called Food Future Inc. And that is how I came to meet Austin and learn about his company, efowl.com, E-F-O-W-L.com. And it's a, I'm going to let him describe it. It is a platform for heritage breed poultry in the U.S. And while we know a lot about tech platforms and helping small businesses sort of take their business into the 21st century by providing them with all the kind of digital tools that they need to do business today, what we're not really experts in on this show are heritage breed agriculture, which the lovely Miss Fairbanks certainly is. So we appreciate her stopping by to sort of have a be the other half of the e-file conversation. I can sort of man the tech side and she can take on the chickens.
Can I say bird's eye view?
Yes. How long have you been waiting to say that?
Well, you know, saving. I may have some other gems in here.
Okay. You should handwrite that on some sort of emoji thing on the story for Instagrams. So Austin, your company efowl just really went live very recently.
Well, we've been in business for about 7 years, functioning as a retailer. We basically would go to hatcheries around the country that produce heritage breed and pasture-raised poultry. And the original idea actually came based on a Thanksgiving table conversation I had with my aunt, who is a farmer, a small farmer, and I asked her if I could make a website for the small amount of poultry she produced, which she normally just sold by a newsletter and word of mouth. She raised some heritage breeds of waterfowl, and lo and behold, there were a lot of people online looking for those specific breeds. So the website got some initial traction right off the bat, and the retail site efowl was launched. Now we would market for a handful of other hatcheries and small farms which produced this type of poultry. But then we realized, hey, we really need to give these marketing tools, these small business tools, these order management tools to the small farmer that's in this agricultural niche, because they have a specific set of needs and frankly don't have the technological resources or the time to just go out and solve their own problems. And while there's so many software tools out there for so many different spaces, the small poultry farmer really has a specific set of needs. So we decided to take what had been working for us over the past 7 years and turn it into an e-commerce marketplace where any approved poultry farmer can have access to a wide range of customers and basically make an online store, write a profile of their farm, say what their catalog is, show the availabilities, and connect directly with customers. So about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks now, we released the MVP of our e-commerce marketplace so that we can have any small farmer who's approved in this space have access to our customer base and have access to a nicely done professional website and the order management tools and the marketing tools, et cetera.
So I have a couple just quick questions on the tech side, and then I'm going to let Aaron ask some questions. So you talk about the specific needs of poultry farmers, what they would need in terms of online commerce. Tell us what that is that a, you know, Squarespace, you know, commerce shop website setup would not facilitate. Because, I mean, they're, you know, online platform, ordering pictures of stuff, taking orders, taking money, taking transactions, you know, following things. I mean, does it really matter if you're shipping a chicken and egg or a cookbook or a pair of socks in terms of like the, well, in terms of the customer interface online?
I think it's not that it's groundbreaking technology. It's really just adding a few additional features that really cater to that farmer. One example of those features that's not going to come from just a Shopify site out of the box is what I like to consider inventory projections. So you need to sell against inventory that's going to be produced in the future, that's produced on a certain date. It's almost like a movie ticket in that regard. So on one certain week, you might have 1,000 Rhode Island Reds to sell, and you need to sell those that week, and they need to be sold that week. And so you need to have the ability to list inventory that's going to be tied to a date well into the future and sell against that inventory. That's one example of a feature that we didn't really find it existed specifically in the context that we needed it. So that was one of the things that we developed in a customized format on an existing shopping cart. Hmm. Another feature.
Go ahead.
Another feature that we found that didn't really exist, and it's, I'm starting to see similar manifestations of this, but it's the concept of you need to fill the shopping cart with a certain amount of products for the order to be viable. Thus, you can't just go order one chicken or one egg. It's not economical. It's sometimes not a safe shipment. You need to make sure that certain minimums are met, and you need to be able to combine certain types of products into a fill the box or fill the cart or fill the basket kind of context. And that was another feature that we didn't really see in an out-of-the-box e-commerce sense that we developed in a customized format. So we can actually have a user interface that walks a customer through the process of saying, okay, I want 5 of this chicken or 10 of these eggs, and then I also need to make sure that I have an additional 10 eggs to fill out the box and make sure that this is an economical shipment.
So do you find that the farmers that you're working with are technologically savvy in terms of they know what kind of things they need, and then they find this and it's pretty easy for them to plug and play? Are you finding that you need to sort of bring people up to speed to the current state of e-commerce online in order to express how helpful you think your product is?
Sure. I definitely think the farmers are savvy in that they understand the business case. They understand the workflow. They can describe the user story of what needs to be done, but it's really hard to translate that into actual technological execution and develop what they're describing. So they're savvy in the business sense, but definitely slightly behind in terms of the technological sense. So we need to show them, hey, on an e-commerce platform, you can use the order management tool to have all your orders listed out and sort them by date or sort them by region or sort them by customer, and you need not have stacks of papers or be using, you know, paper and pencil to organize your orders, ordering system. You can use some of these really easy tools like order management, like customer relationship management tool to handle some of these things that seem like they're such a headache. So there's a lot of things that the farmer is excellent in describing the what needs to happen, how the work process works, but in terms of understanding how they can use technology to accomplish that in a more efficient way is a difficult sell. It's hard to convince somebody, hey, use a computer to do something slightly faster than the way you've been doing it with a pen and paper and a fax machine for the past 30 years.
I think that's the struggle that a lot of people have with a lot of things, not just farmers and selling chickens online. Yeah, it's sort of bringing everybody into the 21st digital century. Aaron, do you have some thoughts about efile.com?
Well, what I will say is you guys definitely lay things out really nicely for someone who is a beginner or interested in kind of learning more or starting down this chain. I will definitely point listeners to check out their FAQ section. I love that you guys talk about vaccination issues, hatching seasons, and my, you know, how to identify duck genders and how to deal with pasty butt. That definitely
is pasty butt part of how you identify duck genders, or
no,
is that a separate thing?
Separate.
Okay. Do I have pasty butt?
No.
I have a whole other thing to worry about now. Does my butt look pasty?
No. And that too, you really kind of break down kind of how this delivery works. I think one of the things that TechBite listeners might be surprised to hear is that often when people are buying chicks to raise out for meat birds or for egg layers, that those chicks are coming in the mail.
Live in the mail. You open the box and they're live in the box from the post office.
And I can.
This is blowing my mind.
I definitely remember when I was up at Flying Pigs Farm, the first time I got a call from the little post office there, like, oh, your chicks are here. And I walked down into the little shop and you could hear them in the back, and you go and it's like, you know, basically like a giant kind of shoebox filled with 300 baby chicks.
Live
baby chicks.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I guess I'm curious about your kind of customer base. You know, you guys list on the site that you are there to serve kind of small and medium size farms, or people who are interested in doing like a smaller backyard operation. What would be like a really like large customer, and what would be like the smallest customer? You talk about kind of the efficiencies of ordering, like how does that scale? Like what's the size of that scale for the folks who are kind of coming to use your services or that you anticipate will?
Sure. Well, I appreciate you noticing our FAQ section, because on the small side, we're really focusing on educating the customer, making sure that they understand what they're getting into and what types of supplies and resources that they need to have on hand. We want to be that educational resource first and foremost. And so the smaller customer is really what we're going to be catering to with that. And that's just going to be the backyard farmer, or sometimes the urban farmer, who just wants to have a hand in their food production. So they might just want to get three chickens that are going to lay in the backyard chicken coop, yeah, and it's going to produce eggs every day. So that's going to be on the small side. And on the large side, we're going to be dealing with some of the farms that are, you know, small organic farms or sustainable farms or family farms that have flocks of poultry. They want heritage breed poultry. They want to produce poultry that's kind of the way we did things, you know, 50 plus years ago, rather than in the more modern over industrialized sense. And so we'll frequently have customers that are placing orders once a year to create a flock that they're going to raise over the summer for a side income for their family farming enterprise. I remember, I have a distant relative who I read a journal entry of hers that was, I think, from the 40s, and she talks about how excited she was to go get her chicks from the post office in the early summer so that she could raise them up and earn an income for her family farming enterprise. So that's going to be the kind of smaller or medium-sized farming enterprise. We really don't cater to many larger-scale farming operations too much. That's just because we're not going to be the price competitive option for that sort of that scale of business.
Yeah.
We're much more focused on the smaller scale hobbyist or family farm, organic farm type of operation.
Well, just it's worth noting, I think, on the smaller scale family farm hobbyist front, one of the Heritage Radio Network hosts, Chef Emily Peterson, she has a very fun show called Sharp and Hot. She has a fun social media stream. Also, you can find her on Facebook and on Instagram at Chef Emily P. She recently, I can't recall if it was the summer or earlier this fall, bought some live chicks, not from EFOWL, from someplace else, but had, you know, video on Facebook of her unpacking her box of live chicks that she'll be raising up on her farm home property that she has in New Jersey. So that was like my first experience of seeing somebody opening a box of live chicks from the mail.
From the mail. Well, I definitely have to give you guys kudos, because I feel like you guys really nicely outlined a lot of the primary issues that I really saw when I was first learning about laying hens and meat birds and things to kind of think about and be aware of. And so I think it's a really great site for someone who A, wants to maybe just do a little research, but then also when you're like ready to start your kind of small scale operation, it's a really nice kind of like one-stop shop. And I think when you're, just to kind of clarify in terms of scale, I mean, a small scale, you know, pasture operation could be purchasing at, like at the farm I worked at, we had 1,000 laying hens, and we raised over the course of the summer 600 meat birds. And that's like super tiny. You look at kind of large scale, you know, poultry operations, and you're looking at hundreds of thousands of birds coming in on a daily basis or hatching out on a daily basis. So it's nice to have something that's a real entry point and is really spreading that message of heritage breeds and genetic diversity and learning about agriculture and like having something that folks can really connect to. I thought it was super cool.
Well,
thank you,
Austin. I want to thank you for phoning in. It was really, it's such an interesting thing. And really one of the interesting cross sections of food and tech, because this is like super low tech, analog tech. I mean, a chicken laying an egg is about as low tech as you can get, and then ordering them online. And Aaron, for staying with us as our farm expert. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to have the ham portion of the show. Stay with us.
And this one is called Torchlight by Rectech. We'll be right back.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do. But the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
If you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly radio show on the Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about the intersection of food and technology. And today we have a show called Ham and Eggs. The first half of the show was a fun heritage breed poultry online ordering platform called efowl.com, where if you're interested in buying some live heritage breed chicks and having them shipped live to you in the mail, this is the place to go. I'm still a little weirded out by opening a box of live chicks. I don't know if I'll ever get over it. But anyway, that was our eggs. And now, as promised, we have Ham in studio with us. We have a very rare visit from Ronnie and Beth Dernan. They're in from Kentucky. They are the owners of the very well-known Broadbent Hams. You may have heard of them because they have sold ham at charity auctions upwards of $1.6 million. I heard recently you sold one for $2
million. Yes, ma'am.
That's amazing.
A single ham?
Yes, charity
ma'am.
Auction. You got it. We have to get one of these million-dollar hams for the Heritage Radio
Network
Charity Buzz auction this fall. They're also fairly well-known in the super foodie circles ever since little chef by the name of Dave Chang put their ham on his American ham plate at Momofuku Sambar a few years ago. And that led to just a maelstrom of articles and notoriety and things like that. So we're really excited to have them here. Their company is over 100 years old, and they have been doing mail order for about 50. And, you know, it's really amazing the things you can go online and buy today. Live chicks and ham.
We got your breakfast covered.
Got your breakfast covered. So, Ronnie and Beth, thank you very much for being here. This is actually their first stop in New York City. Bushwick, Brooklyn, actually. Tell us about your mail order business. Has the internet really changed the way things work for you from the days when it was just a mail paper catalog?
Well, when we bought the company, we didn't have a mail order. We didn't have a website. So that was one of our first things we did was put up a website.
When did you buy the company?
We bought it in 1999.
And that was actually kind of the beginning of the internet.
Mm-hmm, it was. And so our business now is very much geared toward the internet rather than calling in on the phone, which is wonderful for us because it's much easier to process an order in that manner. But we have a big portion of the orders that come in that way. Probably 75% of our mail order come in through the internet.
Now, you really hand make all your hams, and how long does it take to make a ham?
Well, we won't sell any ham before 6 months.
6 months.
And we love to have them at 9 months for our regular country ham. But some of the chefs and the other people want some hams that's even a year to 18 months old, and we keep them for some of the chefs.
So it takes a long time to make the product. I'm assuming that you don't have, it's not like a factory machine where you can just crank up the machine and make more. You probably have a set amount that you make from month to month. Do you even need to sell that much more online? Because I'm assuming you have like a finite production of what you make because it is so specialized and handmade and takes so long.
Well, if we sold a whole lot more, we would have to add on.
Okay.
You're always projecting. It sounds like at a minimum you have to be, six months ahead of wherever you're at. So I feel like, too, especially in the retail space, you get like one big article in a great publication or someone talks about you or a new chef puts on, and then, you know, you're like, hurry up and wait, guys.
It's hard to project because, you know, we try to project a growth every year at Christmas, but you know, we don't want to grow too fast. Our quality is our number one objective. You know, we don't want to lower our quality to get more hams out. So that's where we're at.
Did you think that the internet has really increased your business or the demand for your hams just between the articles and the ability of people to order online? Do you think your business would have grown as fast or become as famous if you didn't have the internet?
That's a hard question to answer because we just started with the internet basically when we bought the company. So we pretty much had it, you know, within 4 or 5 months we had internet. So we had a website. So that's a hard for us to know. It's hard to tell how it was beforehand.
But any article that you get that somebody else writes is better than us advertising. When somebody says your products is good, it's better for them to say it than it is for us to say it.
Do you ever see a spike in the ordering or the traffic on your website and not know why or where it's coming from and then discover an article somewhere or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, we'll do that. We'll have you know, sometimes the phones will just start ringing and people order and then they'll say, well, we saw you here. We saw you there. So, you know, you'll usually figure it out pretty quickly because they'll call in as well.
So now you have a Facebook page for Broadbent Hams and you have a website, but you don't have any of the other social media. We started off the show, we were talking about Instagram stories. You know, we have Twitter, we have Snapchat and all those kinds of things. Are you interested in them? Not interested?
We have Twitter. It's not nearly as active as our Facebook. It's a slower process getting a few of those going. But our Facebook caught on really fast when we put that up a few years ago.
I feel like we might need to explain to people what a country ham is.
Oh, please. Please do.
I'm not going to do it. Yes. Ronnie, I'm looking at you.
I've had the country ham.
Me too.
The aforementioned Momofuku sambar.
I'm like, the world needs
ham
to know.
With the bread and the red eye gravy mustard, which is amazing. So I was actually, you know, secretly hoping that, you know, Beth was going to open up her purse and, you know, put down some ham. I kind of didn't want to ask, but I was secretly like, I wonder if we're going to have ham on the show.
Well, if you get technical with the USDA, to be a country ham, it has to be 4% salt. It has to lose 18% of its green weight when it comes in. And then, of course, it has to have a water activity of less than 9.2.
What is green weight?
That's the weight of the ham when it comes fresh from right off the kill plant or the kill.
So it still has all, like, the juices and the moisture in it. Mm-hmm. And then through the smoking and aging process, it's going to lose some of that water and moisture and get lighter, I'm assuming.
Yeah, right.
Right.
We take the water out in the country ham, yes.
So that's the USDA definition. Do you have a different definition, or is there a different definition that goes back from, you know, to 1904 when broadband first started?
Well, you know, even the settlers, they made country ham. You know, if it comes from overseas, they call it prosciutto.
Right.
Prosciutto is dry cured ham. And,
from Italy, typically.
And country ham is dry cured ham. They may do some things different, but even in the country ham business, every company will do a little something different to make their ham just a little different from the other producer.
So what types of differences? More moisture, less, more salt, the smoke?
Give us your secrets.
Yeah. Or just potentially what the secrets might be.
Well, you know, some of them use white salt, some of them use brown sugar. I mean, white sugar, and some use brown sugar. We use dry honey. I don't know of anybody that uses dry honey in their rub other than us.
Dry honey? Yes. Do you just spread it out and let it dry so it gets, like, powdery, or?
We buy it already powdery, and we mix it with our salt and sugar in our mix as we...
That sounds delicious.
And, you know, some of them have different... lengths of time, they age them at different temperatures, and so every company is just a little different.
And how, I'm assuming the pork that you start with is also probably a pretty important decision that you make.
It is.
And that probably varies from producer to producer as well.
It does. And being small, the smaller you are, the less options you have. Because if you don't buy a semi-load, a lot of the bigger plants don't want to deliver to you. So that, you know, can be a problem.
How many hams are on a semi-load?
And are you considered small?
Yes, we're considered very small. On a semi-load, if you bought the whole load, you're probably looking at around close to 2,000 hams.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's always just, I find, like, the words like small and medium and large, I'm like, I don't know what that means. So I'm like, all right, 1,000 hams would be a full semi-load. Awesome. And it's like a small community of folks. I mean, it's not like, if I go and search online, I'm not pulling up thousands of country ham producers.
No, there's, you know, the country ham producers in Kentucky, used to every farmer in Kentucky almost cured hams
for themselves,
their family, and you know, they would actually sell them to the grocery stores. Of course, you know, over the years the USDA stopped a lot of that, and a lot of the farmers and older country ham people are going out of business. They built these ham houses right in the middle of their farm. Because it was, you know, during the winter times when they couldn't farm, so they made hams and sold them. So a lot of them has, over the years, gone out of business because they didn't want to sell their ham business because it was right in the middle of their farm.
Oh, well, I was just kind of coming back to some of the kind of technology, which is, you know, the theme of Jen's program. when you're thinking about, I mean, you've mentioned the USDA a couple of times. There's such a huge focus in today's food system on food safety. And when you're doing an artisanal product, when you're doing a product that is aged, you know, some of that stuff is like the USDA definition of like, what is it? You're like 4% of this and 18% of that. And, you're obviously lots of eyes on you. Has the technology of like how you make your ham or how your production is being regulated changed? And do you see that impacting kind of the opportunities for kind of quality or flavor or any of those other features?
It hasn't changed too. The biggest thing they want is, you know, you have to document and record keep so much of what you're doing. But as far as, you know, what goes into it, they haven't regulated that. But country ham is such a unique creature.
Yeah.
They really don't know where to put it. It don't fit in with so many of the products that the, you know, and they don't have a category by itself. So some of the regulations they try to push on to country ham, is because of, you know, other products, and they just don't have a good category for country ham. And a lot of people don't understand that you can make a product that doesn't have to be refrigerated.
Yeah, I think there's like a lot of, you know, threats to that kind of production.
The USDA has a lot of issues with things not being refrigerated. I mean, can we talk about the cheese and the eggs and all those things? If you've ever spent any time in Europe, France, there's a lot of stuff that's not refrigerated, and everybody seems to be just fine. I always know, one of the first things that I noticed, I lived in France for a few years, is that when you go to the grocery store, the eggs are on a pallet in the middle of the dairy section. They're not in the refrigerator case. You know, likewise, there's a lot of cheese and ham and dried sausage and things like that that are just sitting there. Just sitting there.
How do you measure the percentage of salt? Like, if you're like, okay, we have to get at 4%, like, you're not like licking the back of your finger and touching, you know, like what are the tools for that?
Well, when we get hams in, of course, I know the weight of that combo of hams, and then I mix it into so many pounds of a batch, and I have an idea this so many pounds of this salt's going to do this many hams.
Right. So there's like an in and out. Yeah. So they're not coming through with like a spectrometer. I think that's for like sugar, I think. But like there's not like a salt version of that.
I was curious about that too. Yeah. I was going to use that word too.
Well, you know, a lot of country ham has a higher salt content than 4%. But if you get under 4%, it's probably going to spoil, you know. If you didn't keep it refrigerated, if you vacuum packed it, put it in the grocery store unrefrigerated, with under 4% salt, probably in a few weeks, that package,
Christmas morning,
that package would probably start to puff up.
Right.
Well, the thing I think that a lot of people forget, or maybe didn't even realize from the beginning, is that a lot of these cooking processes, like making ham, smoking, drying, salting, those were all things that people did before we had the refrigeration as a way of preserving food to keep it for a long time, in addition to just making things be delicious. And I don't know if that information has been lost, or the idea of that has been lost, or we've lost faith in that, or people didn't know. But, I mean, ham was made to be ham so you could keep it.
They had to keep it because they didn't have refrigeration.
Exactly, exactly. Somewhere along the way, we forgot the things that we did and that we knew at the very beginning.
One of my 4-H students, we have about 60 of those that cure hams in our plant for a project each year, and one of them in a speech used the illustration that there was, before refrigeration, before electricity, there was only ham. There was not country ham because there was no other kind of ham. Country ham was it, so there was not the term country ham. It was just ham.
Yeah, well, those are all good things to think about. I'm still thinking about having the ham.
Well, yeah, so I actually, for folks who've never tasted a country ham, I know that you guys are doing an event tonight at the Brooklyn Kitchen, so if folks are out there listening, you know, they can tweet us, text us, get in touch. We can we have some free passes for TechBite listeners.
Woo! But, free passes. But if you're Brooklyn Kitchen tonight.
If you're not local to the area, can you talk a little bit about like what the ham tastes like, or like what are some flavor notes, or how, when you as someone who's tasted ham for years and years, like how do you know you got a really special one? How do I know it's worth $1.6 million?
That was a 16-pound ham, and I think it was in 2014, was it?
2014 was the $2 million ham.
Okay.
And then I think 2011 or 12 was the $1.6 million. This year, in 2016, it was a $600,000 ham.
Oh, interesting. That's a sign of the times, perhaps.
Well, in the other times, they had two bidders went together, and each one of them would give $1 million each for the $2 million. And then this year, it was just one bidder.
We need to get one of those hams for the Heritage Radio Network Charity Buzz auction at the end of the year.
What is the lucky organization that got the big check?
It was an organization that of the bidder's choice.
You know,
And this year, it went to six different charities that they wanted to give it to.
That is so cool.
It's amazing. Really amazing. At the end of each show, and unfortunately, we're already to the end of the show, which is sad because I feel like we could sit here and talk about ham and original recipes for a long time. I always do like to ask all my guests for a little piece of advice that my listeners can use at home in real life. So, you know, we eat a lot of ham in the U.S., ham and eggs, ham sandwich, you know, ham and cheese. What do you say the best way is to serve a country ham? What's the best way to eat country ham?
Well, I guess it depends upon what part of the country you come from. More here in the New York, they like it the prosciutto style. Where we come from, everybody fries it.
Fries it? Is that a deep fry or a pan fry?
It's a pan fry, or put it in water or Coke or coffee and fry it. The biggest thing on country ham is not to overcook it.
Okay. Wow.
We also slow cook hams and sell them that way. We slow cook them overnight in water. And then we slice them really paper thin, and we sell them that way as well. We sell a lot that way.
And maybe they even sold some now because people listening probably
want to
try that.
Yes, please.
I'd like some of that fried ham right now. If you would like to get your hands on some broadbent hams, it is broadbentham.com. You can find them online. If you're in Brooklyn and New York City area, you can find them tonight at the Brooklyn Kitchen.
Yeah.
That is online. Tickets are online. It should be a great event with a lot of ham. If you love radio and you love this show, go to heritageradionetwork.org, click on the beating heart, and give us, you know, maybe what you spent on coffee today. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 charity. We sustain ourselves and keep the lights on because of the love and contributions of our listeners, our underwriters, and our partners. If you go to the Beating Heart, click on it, click the drop-down menu to Tech Bites with your donation, I will send you the Potluck PDF cookbook. I hope you come back and see us next Thursday at 11 a.m. I'm Jennifer Leuzzi, and this is Tech Bites.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.